The United Church of God presents Gary Smith with a sermon titled, By the Waters of Babylon. It was recorded October 14, 2011 in Galveston, Texas.
I asked Mr. Thompson to please lead Psalm 137, By the Waters of Babylon. And I did that for a specific purpose, and the reason was because I wanted that to be in your minds, at least to some extent, as I give my sermon. And I've entitled my sermon, By the Waters of Babylon. And that particular song, with which we're very familiar, is taken from Psalm 137. And Psalm 137 reads this way. It says, By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hung our harps upon the willows in the midst of it. For there those who carried us away captive asked songs of us. And those who plundered us requested mirth, saying, Sing us one of Zion's songs. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it to its foundation. O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed, happy the one who repays you as you have served us. Happy the one who takes and dashes your little ones against the rock. So we're all familiar with that particular psalm, and the song really follows it quite closely. And so as you do sing that song, it is a reminder of what this song is about. So what does Psalm 137 have to do with you and me here at the Feast of Tabernacles? Does it have anything to do with you and me at the Feast of Tabernacles? How does it apply to what we're focused upon here? The millennial kingdom ruled by Jesus Christ. Well, it does apply to that millennial kingdom, that hope that we all have. And so today we're going to go through Psalm 137 and see how it applies to the coming kingdom of God. When we look at this particular psalm, most of us focus on the last part of it. And for us, when we read that, where it talks about dashing a little one against a rock, we find that to be gruesome. We find it to be something appalling. What does that have to do with the millennial kingdom? Well, you'll have to wait till near the end to understand that, but it does have a relationship to what we're focusing on here. So when you look at that particular gruesome aspect of it, you have to understand the background to the psalm in order that you can fully see where the writer of the psalm is coming from. And to do that, we need to turn to 2 Chronicles 36. So let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 36. And we'll look at verses 11 through 14. 2 Chronicles 36, verses 11 through 14. And what we're looking at here is the fall of Judah. Judah has suffered a crisis of leadership, and the nation has suffered and is now going to pay the ultimate penalty by having their city and their country destroyed, and they're being carried away into captivity. And this describes what takes place at the end. Let's begin in 2 Chronicles 36, verse 11. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Lord his God and did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet. In other words, he was unwilling to listen to the prophet who came to him. He was the one who took the prophet's message that had been written down and he sliced it up with a knife and threw it into the fire, completely and totally disregarding what was said. So he didn't humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. And he also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear an oath by God. He made him swear an oath that he would not rebel. And he went against that oath, and he rebelled. He stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord God of Israel. Moreover, all the leaders of the priests and the people transgressed more and more according to all the abominations of the nations and defiled the house of the Lord which he had consecrated in Jerusalem. I think as you look at those verses, all you have to do is look at the country in which you live. And it is an apt description of our nation today. Going on in verse 15, it says, "And the Lord God of their fathers sent warnings to them by his messengers, rising up early and sending them because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. He sent the prophets to them to say, 'Repent, change your ways, cease going in the direction you're going. Otherwise, you're going to suffer the ultimate penalty, death or captivity. Change the path you are on.'" That is a message that should resonate with America today, but it does not. And we are headed in the very same direction they were. Verse 16, "But they mocked the messengers of God, despised his words, and scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people, till there was no remedy. Therefore, he brought against them the king of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, on the aged, the weak. He gave them all into his hand. And all the articles from the house of God, great and small, the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his leaders, all these he took to Babylon. Then they burned the house of God, broke down the walls of Jerusalem, burned all its palaces with fire, and destroyed all its precious possessions. And those who escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, where they became servants to him and his sons until the rule of the king of Persia." Everything that the writer of Psalm 137 knew was destroyed. And he sits in Babylon on the banks of the river, maybe the river Tigris or one of his tributaries. He's sitting there and he remembers back to where he came from. He remembers back to Jerusalem. He remembers back to the temple. And what he is doing is reflecting upon what's happened, all of the destruction that's taken place. As you think about this, you may say, well, how does this apply to you and me? How does this apply to you and me? We're not captives, but you know, we do live in Babylon. Babylon is a system. At this point, it's not a place. It is a system. And it is the system that basically influences this world. It is Satan's system. And when you're home, you go home, you live in that system. You have to put up with it. You have to cope with it. It's something we live in, but we can't be a part of it. And you know, how do we escape from it? In a sense, we've escaped from it as we come to the Feast of Tabernacles. We escape from it in the sense that we can go and focus on something beyond Babylon. We can look to something better, something that is coming that is going to be better than what we experience in this particular time. The Feast of Tabernacles is a chance for all of us to look beyond Babylon. And God has invited you and me here to see beyond its walls, to see something better that we can all be a part of. So as you look at the writer of the psalm here, where did he look as he found himself in Babylon? In verse 1, we've looked at part of it by the rivers. That's where he sat. But where did they look? It says, and as it continues, verse 1, "There we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion." We remembered Zion. They remembered it. Originally, Zion was the name of the Jebusite stronghold that was conquered by David. Eventually, it came to be referred to the city of David, and then it was expanded to incorporate the temple area, and ultimately, Zion is analogous to the temple and the whole city of Jerusalem. And Zion is technically one of the three hills that you find in Jerusalem. You have Mount Zion, you have Mount Olives, the Mount of Olives, where Christ ascended and will descend and touch down at the sounding of the seventh trump, and you have Mount Moriah, on which the temple was built. And as you look at Zion, Zion does represent the church, and it also represents the whole city of Jerusalem. For the Jewish captives living in Babylon, they had to live there and make the best of it. They couldn't go anywhere. Just like for all of us, where do we go? We live in Babylon, and where do we go? We can escape in the words of God. We can escape as we come to the feast, as we keep the Sabbath. But basically, we're there. And we have to and always remember that. So these people had a focus, though. They focused on the city of God. They focused on a place called Zion. They remembered what it was like to go up to that city, to go up to that city on a Sabbath, or to go up to that city, especially at the feast days. They remembered what it was like. They could see they would begin their ascent. Most people, as they went up to the city of Jerusalem, they would go up, and as you began that ascent, you would be eventually come to a point where you could see the city. And you could see the temple, and it would all gleam, and you knew that you were close to that place where God dwelt. They remembered the throngs that gathered to worship God in His dwelling place, the temple. They remembered the ceremonies, the music, the songs, the festive celebrations. They remembered the enjoyment, the fellowship. Think about your experience at the feast. For some of you, this may be your first feast. But for many people here, you've been to the feast many times. Do you have memories of the feast? All of us do. I know that when I first came into the church, my first feast was in Big Sandy, Texas. I had no background. And all these people were excited about the Feast of Tabernacles. And I'd never experienced it, and I thought, what's the big deal here? I didn't know. But now, you know, I've been keeping the feast since 1972, so I have many memories, as all of you do. You remember, you know, here we are, 450 people. But many of you remember going to a feast site, and you've got these memories of thousands of people. Thousands of people in Big Sandy, or thousands of people in the Poconos, or thousands of people in Lake of the Ozarks, or in Jekyll Island. You remember the tents, you remember the metal buildings, you remember all of the things that you experienced there. Some things that weren't so good, you know, if you went to the Ozarks, it was easy to get in, but getting back out of there, boy, that was hard. And that was the way it was in a few of those feast sites. But you have memories. You have memories of the music. You have memories of the get-togethers that you've had. You remember all of those things that you were able to experience as you kept the feast. And that's what the writer of this book was doing. He was remembering all of the good times that they had had. They remembered these things, and then they had to face the reality. The reality was they were captives in Babylon. They would be no more ascents to Jerusalem. Their city had been destroyed. There would be no more assemblies at the temple of God because it had been destroyed as well. There would be no more ceremonies. There would be no more feasts, no more music. Their friends and their families were there with them in captivity. Some of them anyway. Others were dead and gone. Facing these realities, all they could do was weep. Let's go to the book of Lamentations. Lamentations chapter 1. Lamentations chapter 1. We don't often turn to the book of Lamentations, but it fits in quite nicely with what we're focusing on here. right after the book of Jeremiah. And what the writer says here in Lamentations 1, verses 1 through 4, you can see that it relates to what we've talked about so far in Psalm 137. He says, "How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she. Who was great among the nations, the princess among the provinces, has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night. Her tears are on her cheeks among all her lovers. She has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into captivity under affliction and hard servitude. She dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in dire straits. The roads to Zion mourn, because no one comes to the set feast. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness." This was the condition that the writer of Psalm 137 found himself in. And as we think about this, we're able to keep the feast, aren't we? We're able to go up to the feast. But imagine that there is a day when we will no longer be able to observe the feast. When that day comes, and I think it is a possibility, you'll remember back when you're able to go up to the feast. You'll look back on the memories that you formed of going to the feast. The Jewish captives remembered Zion. We've never seen Zion, most of us, but we remember the feast. So in that sense, we remember Zion as well. So we look forward to it, though, just as they did. They look back on it, and they also look forward to it. Psalm 137, verse 2. It says, "We hung our harps upon the willow trees in the midst of it." And as you look at the Jewish people, music was a very big part of their lives. It was a big part of their lives as part of, in the old world, they didn't have video games and all the entertainments we had. So how did you entertain yourself? People used to get together and play instruments and sing. That was one of the forms of entertainment you had. You didn't have any TV to turn on. So people knew songs and people would sing. And because religion was very much a part of Jerusalem and the people of Judah, they many times would sing the songs that were associated with the temple. They would play their instruments during the heat of the day, and they would enjoy singing together with family and friends as part of everyday life. But they had been carried away captive, and so basically they had no desire to play their instruments. They basically hung them on the tree. And a concept that came to my mind as I was thinking about hanging up their harps on the tree was a saying that athletes have, "It's time to hang them up." When you come to the end of your career and you can no longer play football or baseball or whatever sport it may be, you can't do it anymore, you basically say it's time to hang them up. So you hang up your cleats because you can't play that sport with the same skill and ability that you used to. So you hang it up. And in a sense, these people had lost heart, and they had no desire to play their instruments. And so they just hung them on the tree there because they were discouraged and downtrodden because of what they had gone through. So, but there was actually more to the situation here than just hanging them up on the tree. We find out about that in Psalm 137, verse 3, where it says, "For those who carried us away captive asked of us a song, and those who plundered us requested mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion." Now, as you think about the Babylonians, they've conquered Judah. Why do they want to hear the songs of Zion? Is that because they love the music of the Jewish people, the music that is associated with the temple? No, there was a different reason. We're still in Lamentations. Hopefully you're still there. And let's read verses 5 through 7. And it gives us a little bit of insight into the approach that the Babylonians had as they requested music from the people of Judah. Chapter 1, verse 5. Her adversaries have become the master. Her enemies prosper, for the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the daughter of Zion, all her splendor has departed. Her princes have become like deer. They find no pasture, that flee without strength before the pursuer. In the days of her affliction and roaming, Jerusalem remembers all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the enemy, with no one to help her. The adversary saw her and mocked at her downfall. They mocked at her downfall. You call yourself a great nation? We conquered you. We conquered you. Their Babylonian captors knew of the captive people's music ability and wanted them to sing songs of Zion. They wanted them to sing happy songs, joyous songs for their entertainment, to mock and to torment them. To just drive home the point that your God is nothing. Your God has no power. We overcame you and your God. And so this was adding affliction to the afflicted. No songs would serve their captors but the songs of Zion, with which God had been honored. What was their attitude? It's like that of Belshazzar. Belshazzar's having this great party. And what does he do? To show his greatness and the power of his gods, he brings out all of the golden and silver bowls and implements of the temple. And we'll drink and show our might and power and superiority. We'll drink from God's vessels. And the next thing you know, there's the handwriting on the wall. Many, many, tekel, upharsin. You have been tried and found wanting. And that night they fell to the Persians. But that same attitude is being reflected here as they want God's people to sing the songs associated with the temple. And what did they respond? How did they respond? They said, "How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land?" How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? The reason they give for not singing is that they don't want to sing the Lord's song. And that's the critical part of what he's saying. How shall we sing? It's not that they're sorrowful, it's that it's the Lord's song. Their sacred song. Songs that are reflected in the Psalms. It's the Lord's song. It's something sacred. It's peculiar to the temple service. And they didn't want to sing them. Not in a land of idolatry. Not in a land of that was far from God. But they wanted those songs sung. Let's just look at one of those songs in Psalm chapter 9. And understand where the Babylonians were coming from. Psalm chapter 9. I apologize for my voice. About a week and a half ago, I came down with the sinus or something or other, so I'm still battling all of that. And it does affect, I've got the sniffles and other things here. At least the flow is not as bad as it was. But Psalm chapter 9, let's look at verses 1 through 5. Here it says, "I will praise you, O Lord, with my whole heart. I will tell of your marvelous works. I will be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, they shall fall and perish at your presence. For you have maintained my right and my cause. You sat on the throne judging in righteousness. You have rebuked the nations. You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. When you sing that song to the Babylonians, what are they going to say? What are they going to say when they hear this song? They're going to say, "Where is your God who does all these marvelous works? Where is the God who rebukes the nations?" And God's people are being challenged here. Your God has no power. When you called upon your God, He didn't save you. Your city, your temple, everything you owned is gone. We possess it. And you are our slaves. You are captives in our country. So what was their response? You know, it's to me like the picture of Muhammad Ali in one of his fights. He's knocked the other guy down and he's there and he's taunting him as he's down on the ground. And that's what they're doing. They're taunting God's people. So what was their response? We find out in Psalm 137, verses 5 and 6. What was their response? They said, "If I forget you, O Jerusalem, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy." What's he saying here? He's saying, if I forget Jerusalem, if I forget Zion, I may as well forget my ability to play the songs of Zion. If I forget Jerusalem, if I forget Zion, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth so I can never sing the songs of Zion again. Jerusalem, Zion, the city of God, was on their minds. Their heads were filled with it. It was always on their minds. They remembered Jerusalem. Those of the older generation, the younger generation, the best they could do was hear reports about it. And what a magnificent city it was. And for some of those captives living in Babylon, their hearts were full of it. And they would open their windows and they would look out toward Jerusalem and they would pray in that direction. Because for them, that's where God's dwelling place was. That's where they looked. That's where they looked. That was their home, and they had not forgotten it. And you know, what we love, we think of. And these people loved Zion. The writer of this psalm did anyway. So how important is Zion to you and me? How can we forget something we've never seen? I've never been to Jerusalem. Have you? I've never seen it. How can we remember something that we've never formed a memory of? How does that apply to you and to me? Well, as you think about it, God has invited you and me to the feast for years, hasn't He? We have come up to Jerusalem. That's what we're doing here. We have come up to Jerusalem. And the reason is to think about God's city and to think about all of the things associated with it. And that's what we're doing here, is focusing upon something that we are living for, that we hope to be a part of someday. A question for all of us: do we know anything about Zion? Do we know anything about the city of Jerusalem? We do. We know a lot about it because as we go through the Scriptures, it's mentioned a lot. It's the focus of God's Word. And Mr. Simkoviak was mentioning going through the book of Isaiah, and I've been doing the same thing and thinking about that city, and it's mentioned over and over in different ways in the book of Isaiah. And Isaiah gives us word pictures of that city. The Psalms focus upon that city and all of the wonderful things that are associated with it. Let's just take a tour of a few of the passages that talk about Zion. Let's go to Psalm 132. Psalm 132, and we'll look at verses 13 through 18. Psalm 132, verses 13 through 18. Verse 13 reads, "For the Lord has chosen Zion. He has desired it for His dwelling place." You see, that's where the Son of God is going to live after His return. And He's known for thousands of years that that is going to be His headquarters. And He's desired to be there. He says, "This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it. I will abundantly bless her provision. I will satisfy her poor with bread. I will also clothe her with priests, her priests with salvation, and her saints." Who's he referring to there? He's referring to you and me. "Her saints shall shout aloud for joy. There I will make the horn of David to grow." David grow. And the horn of David, of course, is a reference to Christ. "I will prepare a lamp for my anointed. His enemies I will clothe with shame, but upon himself his crown shall flourish." Just one image of Zion. Another is found in Psalm 149. Psalm 149, verse 2. We're very familiar with this because it's a song that we sing. Let's begin in verse 2. It says, "Let Israel..." This isn't a song, it was the one before, it's 148. "Let Israel rejoice in their Maker. Let the children of Zion be joyful in their King. Let them praise His name with a dance. Let them sing praises to Him with the timbrel and the harp, for the Lord takes pleasure in His people. He will beautify the humble with salvation." Verse 5 says, "Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud on their beds." Joy and singing are all associated with God's city, its beauty and its magnificence in the world to come. Let's go to the book of Isaiah and look at Isaiah chapter 4. Isaiah chapter 4, and I just took a sampling of what we find about Zion, about Jerusalem. And God has put these things in there for you and me to read and think about and reflect upon. They are to be a motivation for us to be a part of it. Because someday, Zion is not going to be something far off in the distance. It is going to be a reality that we can all be a part of. Isaiah chapter 4. Isaiah chapter 4, verses 3 through 6. "And it shall come to pass that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy." What will you be when you're there? If you're there now, you'd be called holy because God's Spirit's in you. But when you're there, when the King is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and in that city, and you're there, you will be holy because you will be a part of God's family. You will be called holy. "Everyone who is recorded among the living in Jerusalem, when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the blood of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning, then the Lord will create above every dwelling place in Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and shining a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering and there will be a tabernacle for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge, and for a shelter from storm and rain." Isn't that what Jerusalem will be? It will be a symbol that is a shelter from the sun and from the storm and from the rain. It'll be a place that people will look to and come to and enjoy, and we will be a part of it. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 33. Isaiah chapter 33, and let's look at verse 20. Isaiah chapter 33, verse 20. Look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feast. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, a quiet home, a tabernacle that will not be taken down. Not one of its stakes will ever be removed, nor will any of its cords be broken. But there the majestic Lord will be for us. And down to verse 22 it says, For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us. Look upon Zion. Look upon Zion. So let's go to one final passage I'd like to read here, Isaiah chapter 60. Isaiah chapter 60, and this will be the final example we'll look to here. And there are many, and they're there for a reason, because it's what we're looking forward to. It's what we're looking to be a part of. It's what the psalmists look back to, and we look forward to. Isaiah 60, verses 13 through 15. The glory of Lebanon shall come to you. The cypress, the pine, and the box tree together to beautify the place of my sanctuary. You know, it's interesting that these trees are mentioned, and it talks about that we are to take the boughs of goodly trees and we're to build booths. And why does he mention these trees? They're there for decorative purposes in God's temple area. That's what they're going to be there in the future, and trees are a beautiful addition, a beautiful aesthetic addition to God's temple area. And the reason that they were asked to get those boughs of goodly trees was to remind them of Zion and of being established and their being a part of it. He says here, to beautify the place of my sanctuary, and I will make the place of my feet glorious. Also the sons of those who afflicted you shall come bowing to you. Think about living in Babylon today. Think about that job you lost. That job you lost because you honored God. Think about those people that think you're a fool for going to church wherever you go to church, all the distance that you travel. Think about how crazy they think that you're tithing, that you're doing all of these things that don't make any sense to those living in Babylon. Those people are going to come to you and they're going to say, Wow, I guess you were onto something there. And they're going to see that you were onto something and that you were motivated by something that was really worth the sacrifice. He says here, I will make the place of my feet glorious. Also the sons of those who afflicted you shall come bowing to you, and all those who despise you shall fall prostrate at the soles of your feet. And they shall call you the city of the Lord, Zion, of the Holy One of Israel. They'll see you there, and they'll recognize God's city, which you will be a part of. So do we believe the biblical report? We've not seen Zion, but do we believe the biblical report? Let's go to Psalm 15. Who is going to be there? Psalm 15. Who's going to be a part of it? The psalmist addresses that. Psalm 15. And he asks the question, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell on your holy hill? Who's going to be there? Who's going to be a part of it when it's a reality? Who is going to be there? He says, He who walks uprightly and works righteousness, and speaks the truth in his heart, He's talking about the heart there because what he's talking about is those people in whom God's Spirit dwells, those people who have yielded to God working in them and God's way of life. His righteous way has been written on their hearts. It's what they are. It's who they are. And it's reflected in their thoughts and in their words and in their deeds. And he says here in verse 3, he who does not backbite with his tongue, he doesn't use his tongue to chew on somebody else's back, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against his friend. No, they're loyal to their friends. They're loyal to their brethren. And they would not take up a reproach against their friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised. That is a person who is committed to an evil way. You don't despise them because you hate them personally, but you are intolerant of their way. That way that is alien to God and His whole way of life. You're against that. You despise that vile person and their vile action. He honors those who fear the Lord, he who swears to his own hurt and does not change. That person whose yea is yea and his nay is nay. And when he makes that commitment, will you do this? Yes. And you can count on them. You know they'll be there. You know they're committed. That's all they have to say. Is yes. They don't have to take a vow. They don't have to do any of that. They can just say yes. And because they are like God, that's all that's necessary. He says, who does not put out his money at usury. Many times usury is something that is used to take advantage of the poor, take advantage of the downtrodden. People that have no other option than to go to a loan shark to get money. They have no resources. But the people that will be in God's kingdom will not be that type of individual. Instead of recognizing, you know, taking advantage, they're going to find a way to help that person out. Nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. They would not even consider taking a bribe to make a determination against the innocent. It says, he who does these things shall never be moved. They will never be moved. They will abide in God's house forever. God's house in Zion. And we all have the potential to be a part of it. We all have the potential to be a part of it. Now let's go back to Psalm 137 and look at the more gruesome part of what it says here, because that is something that is mentioned and it does apply. In Psalm 137, verse 7, it says, remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it to its foundation. Interestingly, Edom was related. You know, Jacob and Edom were brothers. So all of these Edomites are related to Judah. And yet, there they are cheering the Babylonians on. Get them. Destroy that city, and they're waiting there like vultures to plunder. And Obadiah wrote a short book about Edom and their actions, and God was not pleased at all with what they did. It goes on in verse 8 to say, O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed? Happy the one who repays you as you have served us. Happy the one who takes and dashes your little ones against the rock. For the psalmist, he looks back to the chief conquering power, Babylon. And as is common in warfare, people aren't controlled when warfare is taking place and people lose control. And unfortunately, they go to excess. The Babylonians not only conquered Jerusalem, but they were cruel and excessive in their cruelty. Excessive in the way that they dealt with the people of Judah. Let's go to 2 Chronicles 36 once again and just make note of what was to take place here and what the people of Judah look forward to. 2 Chronicles 36. Second Chronicles chapter 36, verse 20. Talks about in verse 20 when the sons, the Babylonians are going to rule until the sons of Persia conquer that kingdom. It says in verse 21, and the Persian conquest, what's that all about? To fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land has enjoyed her Sabbaths. As long as she lays desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So they were to, Jerusalem was to be destroyed and to lie uninhabited for 70 years. And then it tells us what's to take place after this goes on here. And I'm just going to read to you Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 12, because it fills in what the approach that the Babylonians had here, and it gives you a little insight. It says, "Then it will come to pass when 70 years are completed that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, the land of the Chaldeans, for their iniquity." So in 70 years after the fall, the Babylonians were to be punished. And then it goes on to describe what takes place in verse 22 of 2 Chronicles 36. "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom." He's conquered Babylon, and he made a proclamation, and also put it in writing, saying, "Thus says the Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the Lord God of heaven has given me, and he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is among you of all his people? May the Lord his God be with him, and let him go up." Cyrus opened the way for Judah to return. And everybody who wanted, you could go back up to the city. But as you look at the book of Jeremiah, how many people returned? How many people went up? A very small percentage of people went back. Most of the people had settled in Babylon, and they had heard about it. They had heard about Zion, but we're staying here. But there were some people that didn't forget it, and they went back. They went back. That's kind of a lesson for all of us. A lesson for all of us. We can forget Zion, and we can become settled in Babylon. And when it comes time to go, what's the big deal? You see, coming to the feast is all part of that. The anxiousness to be here and to be a part of it, to see old friends, to sing, to hear the sermons, to go through all of these things is all part of remembering Zion. And God brings us back here year after year because he says, "I don't want you guys to forget this. I don't want you to forget it. I want you to be there when it becomes a reality." As you look at what's taking place, what's described here in verse 7, where it talks about raising the city to its foundation and Babylon conquering, how does that apply to all of us? When the writer of Psalm 137 speaks of Edom cheering on things, think back to 9/11. Think back to 9/11. Those planes crash into the buildings. And later on, if you looked in the streets of some parts of the Muslim world, what did you see? You saw people dancing in the streets. Yay, the great Satan has been hit powerfully. People cheering in the streets. And there will be more of that. There will be more of that. There are people cheering the downfall of the descendants of Jacob. They want the descendants of Jacob to fall. We've been wealthy far too long. We've been prosperous far too long. And many are there waiting there to plunder. Things haven't changed. We're in a different time, but carnal nature hasn't changed. The psalmist speaks of the daughter of Babylon. Jerusalem was conquered by Babylon, not the daughter. The daughter is to be a future manifestation of Babylon. So we find that when this psalm was written, it was not just for those of that time, but for our time as well. And when Babylon arises, it's not going to be good for the descendants of Jacob, the physical people, and it's not going to be good for the church. It's not going to be good for either the physical people or the spiritual people. Let's go to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13, beginning in verse 5. It says, "And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God." The same spirit, the same attitude that wanted the people of Zion to sing their songs, the Lord's songs, the songs of the temple. But they're going to blaspheme against God, to blaspheme His name, His tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. "It was granted to Him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given Him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship Him, whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If anyone has an ear, let him hear." And what is this telling us? It's telling us that pressure, we're God's people, and pressure is going to be brought to bear upon us to give up what we believe in and to accept Babylon and its ways and to become a part of it. And what the psalmist is telling us, if you want to survive all that, don't forget Zion. Don't forget it. He goes on to say here, so he tells us here that they're going to make war on the saints. That's not going to be a good time for any of us. But let's go back to Isaiah 47. Isaiah chapter 47. There it talks about the daughter of Babylon and what's to unfold. Isaiah chapter 47, verse 1. Isaiah 47, verse 1. It says, "Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin, daughter of Babylon." This is in the future. "Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind meal. Remove your veil. Take off the skirt and cover the thigh. Pass through the rivers, your nakedness shall be uncovered. Yes, your shame will be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will not arbitrate with a man." The daughter of Babylon is to fall. And who is to bring about their downfall? It tells us in verse 4. "As for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is His name, the Holy One of Israel." Babylon will fall with the coming of Jesus Christ. It will fall, and it will no longer be a power ruling this world. Now it talks about the children, the little ones being dashed against the rock. What is that telling us? What is that telling us? Because that is quite gruesome. And what the psalmist is talking about is that when Christ returns and Babylon falls, it's going to be gone root and branch. There won't be any little ones to carry on that system. the whole system will be swept away, root and branch. Let's go back to Revelation 2, chapter 18, which talks about the sweeping away of this entire system. Revelation 18, verse 21. Revelation 18, verse 21. Here it says, "Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore.'" That's what that dashing against the rock is talking about. There won't be any of it left. It'll be destroyed, root and branch. "The sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, and trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore." No more music of Babylon. But you know what songs will be sung? The songs of Zion. No more songs of Babylon, but the songs of Zion will be sung. "No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore, and the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you anymore. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you anymore, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall not be heard in you anymore. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorceries all the nations were deceived. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and the saints, and of all who were slain on the earth." That system will be gone, never to rise again. Never to rise again. So let's conclude. God has brought us here to see the city of God, to read of that city, its king, to talk about the details of that coming kingdom. We can see Zion in the pages of our Bible. And it's worth going through and looking at what it says about that holy hill, what it's telling us about Jerusalem, and all of the wonderful and beautiful images that we find in our Bible. Seeing it in the Scripture helps us to remember it, helps us to not forget it. And the emphasis is very simple, that we would never forget that city. It's coming, and it's going to become a reality, and we can be a part of it. As humans, we tend to forget. We tend to forget because we become caught up in all of our daily things of life, our jobs, our families, our goals, our concerns, the pressures we have to deal with, our desires. And so only by being renewed in the Spirit day by day, Sabbath by Sabbath, feast by feast, can we maintain our focus. We must continually seek God's kingdom and its righteousness. And you know what? As you get up every day and you go out of your house, what are you doing? As you go about your business, you are preparing for Zion. You are preparing to be a part of it. How important is that city? Let's go to Hebrews 11. Final passages here. Hebrews 11. How important is that city? Hebrews 11. Let's take a look at the father of the faithful, Abraham. It says, "By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance." We've all been called out. And we've all been promised an inheritance. And the inheritance that Abraham was promised is the same inheritance that was promised to you and me. He looked forward to it, and we do too. The same inheritance. "And he went out not knowing where he was going." How about you? When you came out, when you began to follow God, did you know exactly where you were going? I didn't. How much did you know about Zion, the city of God? I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about it. But thankfully, through all the feasts, I know a lot more about it than when I started out on this journey. And you do too. He says in verse 9, by faith he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country. He lived in the same place where that city's going to be established, and it wasn't there then. He went to one of its mounts to sacrifice his son. He knew where it's going to be, but it wasn't there in his time. But he saw it. He saw it. And Isaac saw it, and Jacob saw it. And as you go through the people of God, they all saw it. They all saw the city of God. They all saw that city. As he says here that, as he goes on in verse 10, he says, for he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. That's what he looked forward to. That's what we look forward to. That's why we're here. That's why we've made the journey. That's why we've come up to Zion. Verse 13, it says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. That's what you're declaring by being here. You're declaring that you realize this isn't home. This isn't it. There's something more that we want to be a part of, and we're willing to do what we have to do to be a part of it. They plainly seek a homeland, and truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. Do you want to go back? How many feasts have you kept? How far along in your journey are you? Do you want to go back? What's back there? Nope, it lies ahead. It lies in Zion. So we're told, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We don't remember something in the past, but we're focused on the future. If I forget Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. Is it your chief joy? I hope it is. I hope it is. So I hope we can all say, as we enjoy this feast and we focus upon Zion, I hope we can all say as we go head home, Zion, yet we remember thee.